Hi, and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. Glad you can join me. Where I am on WLAW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLAW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audio Boom and iTunes. This is a very special time of year as I talk to you from the Augusta National Golf Club Media Center here in Augusta, Georgia, where the final round of the Augusta National Women's Championship is taking place, where the Drive, Chip, and Putt National Finals takes place tomorrow on Sunday, and then Masters Week starting Monday. And of course, in April, Augusta National is in full bloom. It's just breathtaking. The azaleas bursting with color, vivid pinks, purples, and whites, fairways that are so pristine they almost look painted. Towering pines line each hole, creating a cathedral-like setting that feels both majestic and serene. And, you know, walking the grounds, you're just surrounded by the fragrance of spring, plus the hush of anticipation and the sense that you're standing on sacred ground in the game of golf. There's a rhythm here that builds all week, and it starts with the excitement of the Augusta National Women's Am, and then the Drive, Chip, and Putt National Finals on Sunday, a celebration of the game's future based on golf's grandest stage. And then, as the Masters officially begin, the energy becomes electric. The roars echo through the trees, especially around Amen Corner, where history seems to whisper from every blade of grass. Every step you take, you are reminded of the legends who have walked these fairways and the moments that have defined the game. Well, in this show, we take a deep dive into all things Rory McIlroy, the defending Masters champion who further established his place in golf history when he captured the career Grand Slam and joined the exclusive group Gene Sarazen, Ben Hogan, Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, and Tiger Woods as the only players to have won all four major championships. Alan Shipnuck, a former writer for Sports Illustrated and author of 10 books, he joins me to talk about his latest read, Rory, The Heartache and Triumph of Golf's Most Human Superstar. In this conversation with Alan Shipnuck, we go far beyond the headlines and into the heart of his book on Rory. We explore Rory McIlroy's upbringing in Northern Ireland, the sacrifices his family made so that Rory could pursue his dream of becoming the best golfer in the world. Alan also shares insight into Rory's evolution from a fearless young superstar to a thoughtful and at times conflicted global figure navigating pressure, legacy, and the weight of the career Grand Slam. We dive into the pivotal moments that have defined his journey, his role as one of the game's most outspoken leaders, his personal life, played out in the public eye, and what continues to drive him as he chases history at Augusta. Tiger, as you know by now, will not be at the Masters this year. It's been well documented. His fourth car accident since 2009, his second DUI arrest. He issued a statement on his social media saying, in quotes, that he is stepping away from professional golf to seek treatment and to focus on his health. This all after he crashed his vehicle in Jupiter Island, Florida, near his house, and was arrested on suspicion of driving under the influence. And he pleaded not guilty to the charges. He said in quotes, "I know and understand the seriousness of the situation I find myself in today. I am stepping away for a period of time to seek treatment and focus on my health. This is necessary in order for me to prioritize my well-being and work toward lasting recovery." He said he is committed to taking the time needed to return in a healthier, stronger, and more focused place, personally and professionally. And that is so good to hear that he recognizes that there is an issue and that he is seeking treatment for it and taking some time away from golf, because I know he was due to make many appearances in Augusta, Georgia during the Masters week, from opening up the patch, his 9-hole course design, a municipal course, in Augusta, Georgia, to appearing at the Champions Dinner. He was obviously even contemplating playing at one point, as we saw him at his TGL Jupiter Lynx game a couple weeks back, and he was hitting the ball and playing for his team. So, of course, the anticipation of Tiger playing in this year's Masters was heightened, but all that now is not going to happen. The PGA Tour issued a statement saying that Tiger Woods is one of the most influential figures the sports world has ever known. Over the last year, I have come to deeply appreciate Tiger. Brian Rolapp, the CEO of the PGA Tour, has said, not only for his impact on the game, but for his friendship and the perspective he has shared with me as I joined the golf industry. He said, my thoughts are with him and his family as he takes this step for which he has my full respect and support, end quote. All right, moving on to the Masters and all the compelling storylines, which always happens during this fairy tale week. But a couple of those storylines include, can world number one, Scottie Scheffler, two-time Masters champion, can he win a third? His ball striking is second to none. Scottie won the American Express tournament in January. It was his 20th PGA Tour win. He's coming off just an incredible 2025 season where he dominated with six wins, including winning two majors, the PGA Championship and the Open Championship. So wouldn't it be just incredible if Scottie Scheffler could win a third Masters title? Rory McIlroy, we've been talking about him. You'll hear all about Rory in this show. The defending Masters champion, the Ryder Cup star, he returns to the Masters with a new kind of freedom after winning last year and completing the career Grand Slam. John Rahm, the 2023 Masters champ. We have not seen much of John Rahm as he's playing for LIV Golf, but he is always a serious threat at the Masters. Bryson DeChambeau, also a LIV star, winning back-to-back on LIV this season. Can he control his misses on Augusta National with his power game? The two-time U.S. Open champion is definitely one of the favorites and always fun to watch, Bryson DeChambeau. Xander Schauffele has three top 10 finishes in 7 events so far this season. And at the Masters, Xander has 5 top 10 finishes in his first 7 appearances. And in 2019, he tied for second at the Masters. Is this the year Xander can get it done? Ludvig Åberg. I keep picking Ludvig as the guy because he has so much talent. He's just so close to putting it all together and winning a major title. At the Players' Championship, he held that two-shot lead midway through after shooting a 63. And he extended his lead in the third round to 5 shots. But then he ended up finishing tied for 5th. But hey, he is an incredible ball striker. So much fun to watch. Colin Morikawa was playing so well this season. He won the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, had 2 other top 10 finishes, but he withdrew after completing just 1 hole at the Players' Championship, and he has been plagued with a back injury. So big question mark for Colin Morikawa. It's so sad because he's been playing so well and he has these back issues now. Well, so many people could contend. Shane Lowry, Patrick Reed, Akshay Bhatia, New Jersey's own Chris Gutterup. I mean, Chris, this is his Masters debut. Wouldn't it be a great story if he were to win the Masters? He has 2 PGA Tour wins this season already. He won the Phoenix Open and the Sony Open. Can't believe this is his Masters debut, and gosh, he could just go out there and do it. Well, so many great storylines. Let the games begin. Enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Anne Liguori and my interview with Alan Shipnuck, author of Rory. We take a deep deep dive into one of the most fascinating figures in sport and the defending champion of the Masters, Rory McIlroy. A generational talent, a global ambassador, a player who has dazzled us with brilliance, yet leaves us at times searching for answers. And we are joined by best-selling author Alan Shipnuck, whose new biography, Rory, pulls back the curtain on this superstar, helping readers understand one of the most compelling personalities in golf. Hey, Alan.
Thanks for having me back. I'm always delighted to be here.
Well, the last time you were on the show, you talked about Phil, your previous bestseller, and boy, two very compelling personalities. You know how to pick them.
Yes. And in between, I wrote a book called Live and Let Die, which is kind of the inside story of, you know, the battle for the soul of professional golf between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. And in some ways, this kind of completes the trilogy. You know, I'm not saying I'm J.R.R. Tolkien, but it's like, you know, Phil is, he's the bad guy of LIV Golf, at least in the popular imagination. And Rory being the white knight of the PGA Tour, it's kind of a pleasing bookend to this very tumultuous period in professional golf. Because I would say probably, you know, 4 years ago, Rory was universally beloved character. And in the LIV era, he's become more polarizing. You know, he was kind of the biggest troll of LIV Golf. He was very involved in the tour of politics and very disillusioned. And but that helped me decide I wanted to write this book, because the more complex the personality, the better it is, I think, as a subject of a biography. And, you know, he's not Phil. He doesn't have those same kind of demons at all. But there's been just enough messiness in his love life, his business life, on and off the golf course. It makes him compelling. And then, of course, it's thrilling to watch him play golf, as you alluded to. And in some ways, Rory's very much like Phil, that he's going to be remembered for and defined by his defeats as much as his victories. And then with the Masters last year, there's such a culmination of this long quest. It just seemed like the right time, the right person, you know, for this book.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll get into all of it. But I should add that Alan is the author of 10 books. He spent 25 years writing for Sports Illustrated, has won 13 first place awards from the Golf Writers Association of America, breaking the legendary Dan Jenkins record, which is very impressive, Alan. But look, since Tiger is dominating the news leading up to this Masters week, let's start with the fact that Rory had a poster of Tiger in his bedroom when he was growing up in Northern Ireland. And he always wanted to be like Tiger. So if you would, can you talk a little bit about the Tiger influence on Rory?
For sure. I mean, there's a lot of parallels in their lives, both only children. Each of their families, their parents was singularly devoted to their golf education and, you know, recognized at a young age that these kids had incredible, you know, genius for the game. And so it's not really surprising. And both working class families too, you know, they're not country club kids at all. Rory grew up in, you know, the suburb of Belfast, you know, kind of this war torn homeland in Northern Ireland. And so I think Rory felt a kinship with Tiger at a very early age. He certainly was his hero and his role model. But, you know, in 2009, when Tiger's life started to go off the rails, you know, Rory had really just become, he was just getting the first taste of stardom in golf. He was still very young. And Rory's watched this slow disillusion of Tiger's, you know, artfully, you know, curated facade. And I think he's learned a lot. They've become really close. They were very involved in the tour wars, in reshaping the PGA Tour, and Rory still counts him as Tiger, as a friend and a mentor. But I think he made a very conscious choice that he did not want the life that Tiger has, the scrutiny, the controversy, the all the challenges off the golf course. And so it's interesting that Rory's kind of done it his own way. And Tiger was, you know, he was willing to pay the price. He broke his body and he destroyed his life to be the greatest golfer of all time. And Rory probably had a similar talent, but I think something held him back because he did not want to pay that high of a price. Some fans might be disappointed, but I think you could say that's the sign that Rory's a healthy, well-adjusted person, as he saw what happened to Tiger and he said, I'm gonna do things a little differently. And even if that means I don't win as much, I'll still be happier and I'll still be able to, play golf with my daughter into my old age, and I can still be this beloved elder statesman that spreads goodwill. And Tiger's legacy and his life is much more complex.
Yeah, certainly it looks like Rory has a healthier point of view and lifestyle and is trying to be more balanced. And what do you think Rory would say to Tiger at this point, particularly after Tiger's fourth car accident and his second DUI since what, 2009?
Yeah, I mean, it's a question, like, ever since Earl Woods died, there's been this vacuum around Tiger, and Earl was the one guy who could speak, truth to power to his son. And, Tiger's never going to have an equal on the golf course, but I think Rory's his equal in every other way. He's created his business empire. He's a leader of men. He's been involved in the politics of the sport. I think Rory might be the only player who could look Tiger in the eye and give him some hard advice, and Tiger might take it because he does respect Rory in a way that he respects few others, because he knows that Rory's has the same level of talent and the same level of hunger that Tiger did. And Rory's just, he has a good bedside manner. I think he could do it in a way that Tiger might actually hear it. I think ultimately it's probably going to fall on Tiger's children to be the ones who are going to get him to change. And that's a heavy burden for them, but they're getting old enough. Sam's now in college and Charlie's a senior in high school. Like, I don't think anyone in Tiger's inner circle has that kind of respect from Tiger, clearly, because he's ignored them all to this point. And so it's interesting, if Rory could reach him, that would be really powerful. And if not, I hope that the Tiger's kids are willing to do it, because he's really the reason, he's what Tiger's living for. I mean, they are the reason for him to get better. And hopefully the message will be received.
I have to get your opinion on this because, in my opinion, for too long, the game has revolved around Tiger. And don't you think the powers to be who run golf should look to some other stars to lead these influential boards on the PGA Tour, to captain the US Ryder Cup team? I mean, why is Tiger, despite all these issues in his life for many, many years, why does he still command so much importance to the game off the course? And he hasn't played, obviously, in a long
Yeah, there's
time.
just this cult of personality around Tiger. He's obviously an incredibly charismatic performer. Every golfer on the PGA Tour looked up to Tiger and idolized him in some capacity. And so that just gives you a certain amount of juice. But no doubt the PGA Tour and the PGA of America are rethinking this relationship, because it's presumed that Tiger will be the next Ryder Cup captain. There was supposed to be this sort of soft deadline to announce it around the Masters, and they've got to be looking in the mirror and saying, is this the right guy at the right time? The answer is obviously no. Tiger has to focus on himself. So I think that's probably going to get kicked down the road if it ever happens at all. Tiger is basically running the PGA Tour. He's the chair of the Future Competitions Committee. All decisions go through him. I think that's probably a mistake at this point. And it's always kind of been this whispered thing, like, if you want to get Tiger's attention, the earlier in the day, the better. Michael Bamberger wrote about this recently. Like, he would get erratic, he would get hard to reach. We can speculate why that was. And so, yeah, I think this is a sobering moment for everyone in golf to realize that these distractions and these responsibilities are probably taken away from Tiger's core mission right now, which is to get healthy, to get help. And I think there'll probably be a little retrenching, a little pulling back of his responsibilities administratively in the game.
We can talk about Tiger, for the whole show, but let's stick with
Sure.
Rory at this point. In
Yeah.
1998, Rory, in your book, you said, told the BBC, I want to win all the majors. And some 27 years later, he finally was able to do that, capturing the career Grand Slam last year with his Masters win, and spent
over a decade chasing, you know, that final major win to capture their career Grand Slam. It's a whole different narrative for Rory now since that Masters title. What do you think that narrative is at this point?
Yeah, it's I think of Rory's life in three acts. You know, act one is this genius, this boy wonder who wins everything, gets to world number one, gets those four majors. He's on the same pace as Jack and Tiger, and life is kind of easy. And act two is this struggle to complete this quest, this lifelong dream to win the Masters. And then all the things he has to deal with on and off the golf course, with the business breakups, with the broken engagements, with the marriage, the divorce filing, the reconciliation, and you know, the Masters and then the Ryder Cup at Bethpage really drops the curtain on Act Two. And now the question is what's in front of Rory? It felt like a good time to bring the book out now, and we can look back on how we got here and kind of look forward in a tantalizing fashion and wonder. You know, I think this Masters, you know, next week he's either going to win by 8 shots or he's going to miss the cut. You know, he may be completely flat and uninspired after this quest, and he might just struggle because he won't have the same energy around it, or he's going to be totally freed up and feel like this is the easiest round of golf he's ever played, and he'll just shoot 63 on Thursday and keep going. Like it was very feast or famine with Rory, but. He obviously went through that sort of existential crisis we all saw after the Masters win, and talked about he'd gotten to the mountaintop and he had to look around and figure out what was next. I think the victory at the Irish Open, you know, eagle putt on the 72nd hole to force the playoff, and having no tournament had really tortured Rory like the Irish Open except the Masters. You know, he won it in 2016 and everyone thought he was going to win a million of them, but he hadn't won there since, and there'd been a lot of disappointment, you know, at his national open. And so that kind of got Rory back on track. And of course, he was a towering figure at Bethpage. He went on to win another race in Dubai. He's chasing that all-time record for, you know, money titles in Europe. And so I think Rory answered the question. He still burns to win. He still has magic left. He's only 36. And there's a cute bit in the book. Like, I asked this question of Padraig Harrington, who's his friend and mentor, and Padraig says, "Oh, I know the answer. I asked Rory on his wedding night, and he'd already had a few glasses of wine, so it was a good time to get a straight answer." And you know, he said that Rory told him the number he's chasing is 9 major championships. That'd put him up there with Gary Player. It would cement Rory's status as one of the five greatest players of all time. And by that calculation, he's barely halfway there. And you know, Rory cares deeply about golf history and his place in it. Like, he wants to win an Open at St. Andrews. He wants to win a US Open at Pebble Beach. He wants to be a multiple Masters champion and put himself in a different category than the Danny Willetts and the Charles Schwartzels. And so he cares about these things. And I think he's going to chase them really hard for the next 5 or 7 years. And, you know, you look at Jordan Spieth's body is breaking down. Justin Thomas's body is breaking down. You can go on down the list. Brooks Koepka, Rory's been very healthy. He had that little rib injury in
Good point.
2017, and you know, he hurt his Achilles playing soccer with his buddies a decade ago. But otherwise, he has kind of that long rhythmic swing, like a Phil Mickelson, that holds up, and he takes very good care of his body. So I think there's a lot of big championships in Rory's future, and it's going to
You
be
know, it'd
fun
be
to
interesting
watch.
to see if he possesses this that same hunger, that same drive to defend his Masters title as he did to win it for the first time and capture that career Grand Slam. But that's why they play the game. His parents sacrificed everything for their only child, and this story has a happy ending. Very few do to that extent. You wrote in quotes, "Parents sacrificing everything for their child is a tale as old as time." Who couldn't get swept up in the journey of a working class family from a war-torn land, nurturing their only child into an all-time legend in the most patrician of sports? And that it's a dream come true for any parent, but what a fairy tale ending for his parents.
It's neat, and that's what's fun about doing a biography is you can get really into the details. And so, like, you know, you kind of always heard that Rory's family His parents worked really hard to support his golf dreams, but I didn't realize the extent of it until I really got into this book. I mean, Jerry McIlroy would get up in the morning and he'd go to this local rugby club and he would vacuum the hallways and clean the toilets and get the whole place ready to go. He'd spend his whole morning doing that. And then he'd go to the local golf club and he'd serve as a waiter and as a bartender till 6 o'clock. So that's already a long day. Then he would race home, have dinner with the family, and go back to the rugby club and serve as a bartender till midnight. Then he would go home, he'd give his wife a kiss, and she'd walk out the door and she'd go to the local, 3M factory and place rolls of packing tape into boxes. Like, you can't imagine a more soul-sucking job to do all night long. And at some point when he was a kid, Rory said to his parents, "Why are we not like a normal family? They are almost never together." His parents were just these two ships passing in the night. And they recognized that their son had something special. I mean, Jerry McIlroy was a scratch golfer. His brother, Colm, had the course record at their club with a 63. They came from a line of golfers. They could see Rory's talent. And on Rory's mother's side, there's some great athletes, including an uncle who played big time, Gaelic football and rugby. And so he was born with some tools, obviously, hand-eye coordination and things like that. But he just had this obsession, and he was around really good players his whole life, and he just developed this gift. And his parents just never wanted to feel like we didn't give him every opportunity. So all this money they made, they poured into Rory traveling to Hawaii, to San Diego, to Florida to play against real competition. And that sent him on this journey. And it's really an incredible story how far they've come as a family.
Can you share that story that when you were talking to Jimmy Dunn, that he got from Rory's dad, Jerry, about Jerry spending the last few dollars on a bucket of balls for Rory when Rory was only nine? I think that tells a lot about the parenting and what they were trying to instill in their kid.
And so Jimmy Dunn, of course, is this kingmaker in the world of golf. He famously the first man to be a member at Augusta National, Cypress Point, Pine Valley, and Seminole simultaneously, and
Shinnecock.
plus Shinnecock and a bunch of others. And it's good to be Jimmy Dunn. And he became close friends with Jerry McIlroy, and he's the reason Jerry McIlroy is a member at Seminole. I doubt there's too many guys at Seminole who clean toilets for a living, but intended bar. But that's so Jerry has had his own sort of great American success story. But yeah, the tale you're talking about is, Rory's just a wee lad, and Jerry and Rosie are working as hard as they can, but they're spending it as fast as they make it on Rory. And so they go to the driving range, and Jerry's down to his last few quid until payday. And so he goes and he puts some money into the ball machine, and he gets however many balls he can. And Rory's disappointed. He wants to hit, five buckets of balls, as was his custom. And Jerry says, "Listen, I've worked hard, your mom has worked hard, but all we have left is in that bucket right there. And I want you to hit every ball like it's the last hole of the Open Championship." And it really tells you a lot about the level of sacrifice, the level of commitment, and why Rory has this gratitude for this journey he's traveled. He has all the toys, he has the mansions, and he has the jets and the cars and the watches. And the McIlroys like the finer things in life, but Rory still has this appreciation. When you see how he moves through the world and how he interacts with people that he doesn't have to be nice to, they're just the clubhouse attendants, they're the valets, they're the fans in the parking lot, but he's always gracious, he's always kind. And I think they've never forgotten where they came from. And that's a charming attribute in a superstar athlete.
Sure, similar to Arnold Palmer, for sure. Arnold had, treated everybody equally, whether you were a janitor or a president, which is, I think, had a positive influence on Roy McIlroy as well. Well, Roy was 15 when he ended his schooling, and one of the tidbits in the book, which surprised me, came from, I guess, Roy's uncle. And you quoted him in the book. He said his nephew's impetuous decision making in business, romance, launching press conference barbs could all be traced to a lack of higher education. End of quote. Those are sharp words coming from an uncle, right?
Yeah, I mean, to Rory's credit, he's tried to continue to expand his mind and to better himself. You know, he's a voracious reader, and not just of sports books, but like biographies, business tomes, self-help, even sort of new age philosophy. And I think there's some regret that he has that he didn't go to continue his education, and maybe it's some self-consciousness. And as he moves in these very rarefied airs now, and I mean, two of his best friends are two of the richest men in Ireland, JP McManus, Dermot Desmond. Like, it's a function of how far he's traveled in the world. And so, yeah, I mean, part of what makes Rory appealing is that he wears his heart on his sleeve, and that not just on the golf course, but also in the press room. And he says a lot of things, and they're from the heart. And but he also changes his mind. You know, he has some buyer's remorse. And to me, that's actually a positive attribute, where he'll take in new information and he'll say, you know what, I was wrong and I've changed my mind. Like, that's to me is a sign of an open mind. And it should be celebrated. But in the world we live in now, it's like you have to take a position and you have to defend it to the death. It's like, I'm right, you're wrong, and go screw yourself. Like that, you see that in our political discourse, obviously, and even everyday life. And so I give credit to Rory. He'll raise his hand and say, I was wrong. And whether that's, you know, calling the Ryder Cup a meaningless exhibition, whether saying he didn't care about the Olympics, you know, he had a very public change of heart on both of those. And it on down the line, but it makes him, to me, more human. It makes him more likable. It makes him more interesting. And
Sure.
you know, we've gone through now decades of Tiger Woods press conference where it's just a word salad. He says nothing. There's no
Right.
content.
Nothing
He
at
won't
all.
take a stand on anything. And Rory's not that way at all. Like he's passionate and he puts it out
Sure.
there. And
He's so refreshing. And, you know, he emerged as the spokesperson for the PGA Tour in their fight against LIV Golf. And then he kind of did a 180 on that. But interesting, back at the US Open at Brookline in 2023, a day after I asked Phil Mickelson the same question, and Phil looked like he was going to kill me, I asked Rory, what does legacy mean to you? And with Phil, I asked, what does legacy mean to you? And do you think it's changed since you've since joined LIV? But with Rory, you know, he had a great answer and basically talked about how important it is. Money can't buy one's reputation. Money can't buy legacy. He says you strip everything away at the end of the day and you're left with how you make people feel and what people thought of you. He said that's important to me. And I still believe he feels that way. And I just think, you know, that's a positive attribute of Rory McIlroy.
totally agree with all of that. And it's why he was never tempted to go to LIV Golf, because he does venerate those who came before him. He does care about golf history, and he is aware of his career victory totals, and he wants to keep moving up the list on the European Tour and the PGA Tour. And those things matter to Rory. And you know, the LIV Golf, it's interesting because he was fighting the good fight in his mind. And Jay Monahan was hiding out in the tour headquarters, and Rory was on the firing lines every time he teed it up. Every round, he was talking about LIV. And he made it personal. You know, he took plenty of shots at Greg Norman. He pretty much ended his friendship with Sergio Garcia. I mean, he was a groomsman at Sergio's wedding, and LIV broke up the romance. Now, they've sort of patched things up since then. But, and then this framework agreement came down, and Rory was very disillusioned. But, and then he started calling for reunification, and he supported the Saudi investment in the tour. And again, people said, well, he sold out, he, you know, but it was actually a very nuanced, pragmatic view. And he said it right out his first press conference in Canada, right when the framework agreement came down. And, you know, he said he felt like a sacrificial lamb, but, you know, he said, if I take myself out of the situation, this makes sense. If the Saudis want to be part of golf, we should partner with them, not fight them. They have more money than we do. We can't win that battle. Let's get them invested. Let's improve our product. Let's make them a positive force. And I thought that took a lot of courage and it took a lot of humility to say, yeah, okay, they did me dirty, but I'm going to look at the big picture here. And, again, people criticize Rory, but he was just being a realist. And I thought what he said made a lot of sense and it showed a lot of sophistication. But again, it's like you're not allowed to change your mind anymore. And that was forced upon him. It was he got sold out by these backroom bureaucrats. And but he, to his credit, he didn't cry about it. And he just said, okay, the terms of engagement have changed. Let's see how we can make this work. And it's a big reason why he's been marginalized from the ongoing discussions on tour. He still feels like the game should be put back together and be better off if you could get Bryson and John Rahm back on the PGA Tour. And he's trying to be conciliatory. Tiger, his friend and business partner in the TGL, blackballed Rory from returning to the board because Tiger doesn't want a deal. He's Old Testament. And so it's a fascinating little behind the scenes drama. It all plays out in the pages of the book, but it's still a Rory has been this powerful voice, and that the tour has sidelined him in favor of Tiger is part of why we are where we are, where both sides are still at war. And we'll see how it changes. If Tiger goes off the board and that vacuum is filled by Rory, the tenor definitely changes.
Sure, that's why I asked earlier if you think they're still close after, a lot of these differences of opinion when it comes to Liv and the PGA Tour.
That's how ruthless Tiger is. Even though they'd had forged this close friendship and they had this business relationship to the TGL, that he still blackballed Rory. I think Rory has a big enough heart. He'll let that go for in the service of maybe trying to be a good friend to Tiger, but it wouldn't flow the other way.
Right, exactly. Well, fast forward after the Masters win and the career Grand Slam a year ago, Rory admitted to losing motivation, Alan, for a bit after that Masters win. And then he got pissy at Quail Hollow and would not talk to the media there. And that extended to the US Open. And at Quail Hollow, he was upset that reporters named him in that, I'll call it, driver gate. Which was crazy. He finally said at the US Open that he was frustrated with the media. He said he's been totally available for the last few years. He said he felt he earned the right to do, whatever he wanted to do. And wasn't there an incident between you and Rory on the driving range? Can you describe what happened?
So that, when you do a biography of a famous person like Rory, readers want to know what was their involvement. And it's a natural curiosity. And so I did go to Rory at a couple stages in this process of writing this book and asked if he'd sit for interviews and his manager, Sean O'Flaherty, and they molded over and ultimately declined. And that's okay. I mean, Rory's time is quite valuable. And he didn't want to sit with me. I didn't take it personally. I've had a lot of access to Rory through the years. I've been covering him his entire career. I mean, I remember the first time I ever saw him swing a golf club was the range of the 07 British Open when he was still an amateur. And so I just went on my merry way. But I have a relationship with Bloomberg Business Week, and I was talking to them about doing a story on Rory's business empire because he's been very clever at
Sure
expanding
has.
it. And yeah, it's all detailed in the book. And so and that would be a way for me to sit down with him, and of course I would have used that material for the book too. So it's kind of a twofer. So yeah, at Oakmont I was talking to his manager Sean O'Flaherty on the range. This is before Rory's second round. This is like half an hour before his tee time, and Rory kind of looks back and sees us and he's like, hey, Alan. And so we look up, and I wasn't even paying attention to Rory. I was really focused on this conversation with O'Flaherty. And I look up and we make contact, and he's like, fuck off. And me and O'Flaherty kind of froze. It was such a surprise. And Rory takes a couple steps and points his driver at me. He's like, seriously, fuck off. And so there was a packed grandstand behind me, there were NBC cameras. It didn't seem like we were going to have a productive conversation in that moment. So I kind
I
of
guess
wandered
not.
away. But 2 days later, I waited for him in the parking lot after his final round. And I basically was like, dude, what was that all about? That was so unprofessional. And so we had a whole philosophical conversation about the book. And what the crux of it was, he said, it pisses me off that you're making money off my name. And I said, Rory, you made like $87 million last year. You commute to work in a G6. Like, book money is a tiny fraction of Grand Slam money, but it's really not about the money. It's about the control, because Rory has total control over his life and his image. And he knew he'd have no such control over this book. And that's unsettling for him because he calls the shots in everything. And so that's kind of how we left it. But there is a
Do
happy
you think
ending.
Rory said didn't want to do the book, or his agent didn't want him to do the book?
Both, but Rory is clearly calls the shots on everything in his life, and so it was his call. But there's kind of a cute little story. So Pebble Beach, last month, I live locally, I covered the tournament. Rory's defending champ, and that was a very important victory on this march to the green jacket. And so I just gotten the books in, so I met Sean O'Flaherty for breakfast. I gave him a couple books, and I said, listen, I wouldn't pay you the courtesy of giving you the book so early if I thought you were going to hate it. Like I said, if you guys can read
Sure.
this with an open mind, I think you'll appreciate it. And to me, it's a feel-good story. It's
It
not.
is. I don't
It's
think
not.
you really got too critical of Rory
No,
in
I
any
think
regard.
exactly. I mean, Rory's had. I think he's conducted himself with a lot of class and dignity in a very public life, and he just doesn't have the demons of a Phil Mickelson. So, I give the book to Sean that afternoon. Rory comes into the press room for, his pre-scheduled press conference. He walks right up to me, shakes my hand. He's like, hey, thanks for the book. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to reading it. And I said, keep going. I think you'll like it. And he said, I'll tell you if I do. And so that was like a peace offering. It was very public. The whole press corps was there, tournament officials, tour officials. Now on Sunday, a few days later, I've typed up my game story. I've sent it in to Scratch Golf, and I'm walking to my car. And it's dark and it's misty, and the whole place is cleared out now. And I see a couple of figures walking toward me, and I know from 100 yards away, one of them is Rory. I just know the way he walks. I know his silhouette. I've been watching his whole career. And sure enough, it was. He was with his caddy. They were going to get some food. And I mean, I made a joke, like, of all the people you're going to meet on a dark and stormy night in Pebble Beach. And he laughed and he said, I read the first chapter of the book. It's good. It's funny. I liked it. So me and Rory are in a good place, but ultimately I didn't really care. I didn't write the book for him. I mean, I write for the golf fans, and that's, 25 years at Sports Illustrated and a bunch of crusty old newspaper guys as my editors. And they felt like there was a right way to do the job. And you're brutally honest with the readers. And the collateral damages, sometimes the players are unhappy, sometimes the managers are unhappy, but the job is the job. And that's always kind of been my North Star. So I wrote the book I wanted to write. I'm happy that Rory's enjoying it, but that wasn't the objective.
The book is called Rory Allen, a Shipnuck. Let's talk about Rory McIlroy and his Ryder Cup history, because, gosh, he's played in eight Ryder Cups, every Ryder Cup from 2010 to 2025. And I agree with what you said, that Rory could go down and should go down as the most prolific winner in Ryder Cup history. And did you follow him around at Bethpage, especially when the crowds
I
got
did. I
overly
did.
abusive?
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, he's actually been on the part of six winning teams. Like, of all the modern Ryder Cuppers, only Lee Westwood's ever been on more with seven. And so, Rory is the key bridge between these two eras of dominance, the Sergio, Ian Poulter, Lee Westwood teams, and now the John Rahm, Tommy Fleetwood teams. The one constant has been Rory. And he's 2.5 points away from being third on the all-time point list. He'll get that at the next Ryder Cup, probably. Like, he's going to have every Ryder Cup record there is. He's going to play another three or four of them, maybe more. And so, funny thing that when you talk about the legacies of top players, people don't mention the Ryder Cup, except for Seve Ballesteros. And Rory's already won more points in Ryder Cups than Seve did. And so, yeah, I thought Rory's performance at Bethpage was monumental. I thought it was the most hostile golf environment of all time. And for him to get 3.5 points over the first 2 days, help Europe build this insurmountable lead. Like, he was a towering figure. There was a lot of reporting about, and it was all kind of in code language, like, oh, the fans said personal things to Rory. They crossed a line. I mean, it was worse than that. And, you know, his wife was out there walking with him, and there was a lot of comments about Rory's marriage and about these rumors that have followed them. And, you know, Erica McIlroy had to listen to all of it. And that's why Rory was so fiery. You know, there's that video of him flipping off the fans. His partner Shane Lowry almost waded into the crowd and started throwing punches. Like, no one, you yell at a Ryder Cup, you know, Rory, you suck. Okay, it's not great, it's not creative, but it is what it is. But when you start talking about his marriage, start talking about his wife, like, that's different. And, you know, yeah, I'm sure the Yankees hear that and maybe the Rangers hear that, but, you know, golf is just different. It's a different level of decorum traditionally. It's also much more intimate. You know, when you're at a big arena, you can't get that close to the players generally. Golf is just a thin little rope that's separating you, and it's a much more cloistered environment. And so, Rory's play at Bethpage is going to go down as some of the most macho golf that we've ever seen. And it was deeply satisfying for him and his teammates to witness it.
If anything, it made him more fiery and more, the adrenaline kicked in even more so. I mean, I don't think, you know, if the perhaps the fans knew that they were just going to make him, you know, just more intense and better, perhaps they would
Those were not masters of psychology in
have.
the Bethpage Gallery.
And I'm sure they were not knowledgeable golf fans either, but how much of that personal saga took its toll, do you think, on Rory's image?
I went to Bethpage needing an ending to the book, and it really, to me, the whole year was this redemption story for him as a player to finally win the Masters, finally slay the dragon, but also for Rory as a man, as a husband, because, you know, he filed for divorce and then he changed his mind a month later and they reconciled. Marriage is complicated. Like, no one would want to have their ups and downs with their spouse in the public eye. And for Rory and Erica, that's what happened. And, you know, you can't imagine anything more challenging for a couple, but they came through it. And on that Saturday afternoon at Bethpage, after the second match, when the fan behavior had been at the absolute worst, I saw Erica McIlroy in the gap, you know, behind the 18th green. And I kind of wandered over because I knew Rory was going to come find her. And he did. And they had this incredibly passionate embrace. And both of their eyes were glistening because he knew what she had just been through. And he whispered in, you know, her ear, "I love you so much." And it was incredibly personal and powerful. And then, you know, after the victory, during the press conference, Rory talked about his wife in the most emotion he's ever really showed, talking about her in such a public venue. And then there was this little stolen moment afterwards where he was, you know, his eyes were watery and his voice was hoarse, and he was talking about it as the best year of his life on and off the golf course, and how thankful he was for his wife and for his daughter. And it really kind of completed this redemptive arc for him as a human. And so that's kind of how the book ends, and it's part of the feel good aspect to it, because, you know, there was a lot of rumors that floated around about Rory, and ultimately we'll never know if they're true. Only Rory knows if they're true. And it doesn't even matter. It's what matters is where his heart is, and is clearly with his wife. And it's a beautiful thing. Like, we all have our ups and downs. You know, some of us are divorced or not, whatever, but we can all relate to that struggle. We've all had breakups. We've all had our heart broken. And for, you know, to Rory and Erica to come back together like that in such a public way, and I thought it was really lovely. And you know, just on a human level, and then you layer in the golf on top of it, and so it just gives us the book such a crescendo with the Masters, with the Ryder Cup. It was an incredible season to be bird dogging Rory, and so much stuff happened that was unforgettable.
Unbelievable. Well said. Just a brilliant book. Before I let you go, Alan, what surprised you, or did you learn anything about Rory in all your research and all these years covering him that you didn't know that really surprised you about him?
I mean, tons of stuff. Like, that's the fun of a project like this, is to go so deep on the details. Like, you feel like you're an archaeologist, sifting through all these old newspaper stories and old photographs and, high school yearbooks and looking at photos on the walls of these clubs in Ireland and Northern Ireland. And then you feel like a private detective when you're trying to track down people from his past. And one person tells you one story and, oh, you got to talk to this guy. And then you spend all this time and you track them down. They're like, no, it wasn't me. It was this other guy. And then you're trying to find them. And then, he's dead, but oh, his son has a scrapbook and whatever it is, like the chase is really fun. And so, I mean, there's so many things, but again, there's not the earthquakes like in the Phil Mickelson biography. And I'm sure some readers will be a little disappointed, but there's so many little nuggets. And for me, it's about providing the context, the framework of understanding, and taking people places they can't go, and tell them things they don't already know. And I mean, I feel like there's stuff in every chapter, and that's what my role is, because Rory's had a public life. People kind of know his story. If the book's going to work, it's because you have to have so much fresh information
Absolutely.
and perspective. I was there for all the wins and all the losses, and so I have my own thoughts and I have my own analysis. But I really relied on the voices of so many other people who lived it with Rory, and I think that's what gives the book its intimacy.
Who are you picking to win the Masters?
Well, sentimentally, I'd love for Rory to win. That'd be amazing. Obviously, he tweaked his back, and he hasn't won so far this year, but he has played some good golf and he's highly motivated. I feel like Jon Rahm is dangerous. He's kind of like this wounded bear. People are questioning his love for the game, his priorities. He's a man of immense pride. He's been playing at a high level, but since he went to LIV Golf, he hasn't contended in a major. So I feel like he's due to bust loose one of these days. I'll take Rory or Rahm, but there's a lot of it's going to be. I feel like this Masters is pretty wide open. Scotty is not as big a favorite as he has been. Morikawa is now hurt. It's hard to identify a favorite based on their form, and so that's kind of fun. We'll see. But the Masters, the Masters. We know it's going to be a shootout on Sunday afternoon, and it would be awesome if Rory's part of it. Just because if you could do it again, if you win back to back, that puts you in a whole different category. And so I have a partisan rooting interest, clearly, but I think it's going to be fascinating to see how he answers the bell there.
Brilliant book, Alan. Congratulations. The book's called Rory. We'll see you in Augusta.
I look forward to it. Thanks for having me, Anne. I really appreciate you.
My thanks to Alan Shipnuck and to My Good Sound Production. As Jack Nicklaus once said of Augusta National, I always said that if they have a golf course like this in heaven, I want to be the head pro. I love that quote from Jack Nicklaus. Have a happy Easter, a happy Passover, and I look forward to talking with you next time, right here on Sports Interview with Anne LaGorre.
It's a bittersweet.